everyone. Welcome to the Uphill Athlete Podcast. Our mission is to elevate and inspire all mountain athletes through education and celebration. My name is Alyssa Clark, and I will be your host today. We've been brewing a fantastic new season for you, and I'm thrilled to introduce the first episode in our new educational series on all things altitude. For our first episode, I have two of our altitude specialists on the Uphill Athlete team who are joining me to provide an introduction to altitude. Chantel Robitaille and Martin Zohr have extensive knowledge and education in altitude training, effects, considerations, and more. Thanks for being on, you two.
Thanks, Alyssa. Great to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, me too.
So before we get into our kind of introduction to altitude episode, I'd love to hear from both of you of what drew you to study altitude and its effects on athletes, and what your background is in these studies, and actually, like, kind of what is your specialty within altitude? Because it's a big topic.
Yeah, I would agree. It definitely is a big topic. And we could probably, well, we will be talking about this for days. I got into studying altitude since I was living in Switzerland once upon a time, and doing a lot of running and skiing and things like that. And I was also coaching ultramarathon runners. And as much as I understood a lot of physiology, what I really didn't feel I understood enough was the physiology, the impact of altitude on physiology and also on athletes at exercise, especially when they're working really hard in races. And so I actually changed careers completely. I was sort of a part-time coach and full-time corporate woman, wearing heels and business suits. And I went back to school and I got a master's degree in high altitude physiology so that I could understand that better. And although I, you know, dedicated time to doing that, it's still an ongoing process of learning because science isn't fixed. Coaching is a practice, so still always learning. So I'm excited to be working with Martin, who is actively studying in school now, and so it's cool to continue learning through his experience as well.
Yes, so thanks, Chantel. I think it's been quite a journey now. Today we're here. I'm an Uphill Athlete team coaching people for to climb mountains and Everest and all the others. So it's really a dream. Maybe even multiple dreams come true. But I come from small country, Czech Republic. There's not really mountains. We will talk about those categories of what is it, like moderate altitude. So it doesn't even fit into that one. But I kept dreaming about mountains, mountaineering, and reading books about legendary alpinists. And eventually also became one also, alpinist, climber, made it to Chamonix where I live here right now, working at a, let's say, high altitude, 3,800 meters for I think 12 years on a Gil de Midi lift, which is pretty legendary around here. And then also performing as an athlete, as a runner and climber, and actually connecting all those dots then to some fast ascents in even extreme altitude. And also wondering what actually lies behind it and the physiology of it. And so when I studied sports science in back in 2015, and I was supposed to write the final thesis, so it had to be about altitude physiology. So I talked to my professor and he agreed, so that's where I really dug in to the theory and chose a topic of faster acclimatization. And that's actually what I'm doing now, continuing this project as a master student in Östersund University in Sweden. And it's an ongoing, it will take a while to make the experiment, to find the right group of participants in the study. But I'm super excited and learning in the process and bring it all together to this job. So yeah, exciting.
Love it. And both of you have already, I think, touched on this, is that we use the general term altitude, but it's really a lot more complex than that. Martin, you've already said high and extreme. So how do we define different altitude zones? Because it's certainly a different effect to be at, say, 8,000 feet, or that's about 2,500 meters, as opposed to being up in, you know, 24,000, 25,000 feet, which is above 6,000 meters. I'm trying to do the conversions right.
Nice work, Alyssa.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, on the fly, working with a lot of European athletes. So Martin, can you kick us off of how do we define altitude zones?
Yeah, so I had to actually look up some papers before this podcast to maybe review this, but actually I think let's just keep it simple. And so I would say until maybe 1800 meters, 1800 meters, there's just not enough hypoxic stimulus, or just the hypoxia doesn't really affect the body as much. So I would really call it low altitude. And maybe the next category of moderate altitude until 3000 meters, which might be 10,000 feet, I would call it like a really significant threshold where, okay, if you go above that level, some people might already struggle. If they don't really respect the process of acclimatization, they might even get sick and or just have some severe symptoms. So I think that moderate altitude is quite important because athletes, like endurance athletes, wanting to perform at sea level or low level of altitude, they seek this altitude to train and to get those adaptations to actually then boost their oxygen carrying capacity. And so we will talk about these adaptations later, but that would be then this category. And so the next one would be high altitude, 3,000 meters until 5,000 meters, I would say. And truly anything above 5,000, I would call it extreme, because then it really is the altitude we find in the highest peaks in the world. So that's really a realm that you need to take your time for the adaptations to occur, to adapt and to respect that process. And maybe in these extreme altitudes category, I would say above 7,000 meters, nobody lives permanently. I think it's actually even lower, like 6,200, 400. I'm not sure exactly now, but it's physiologically almost impossible. Above 7,000 meters, I think you're really kind of going down slowly but surely. And then so-called death zone, above 8,000, the hypoxia is so severe that you don't really want to be up there for too long without supplemental oxygen. Now, here we're talking, not many people go there without supplemental oxygen anyway. And so I think it's also good to know that what does it actually relate to? With altitude, we're looking into the reduced oxygen availability. And this is actually a function of the barometric pressure, which is lower and lower the higher we go. So I think I like to think of it also that way, just to have an idea of what is actually happening in altitude.
I was just going to say, I think that's an important distinction that I feel some people don't quite understand well about, you know, they think that you hear different ways people describe about there's less oxygen in the air, things like that. It's actually, we always have about 21% of oxygen that's around us in the air. But when we are going up to higher altitudes and the barometric pressure is lower, that means the concentration of the oxygen molecules that we breathe is going to be less. So I think that's an important distinction for people to understand about altitude. And I think that's a good definition. And as Martin said, he had to look it up. I think there's lots of different definitions, right, of these different categories of, you'll see some different tables that will have three distinct altitude zones. Some will have four, some will have five. I think the important difference is, you know, we think about the altitudes where we do have a lot of people who are tend to be living and training. We have places that people will, altitudes that people will visit in a transient way for a particular mountain objective. We have, you know, different places where people will go very seldom. So those are important distinctions for us to be able to make, to learn some of the differences in terms of how our bodies will adapt, how we will be able to perform, and places where we absolutely shouldn't be spending too much time or should be spending time carefully. So I think that's what we'll try to focus on today, is talk about that a little bit more to help understand a little bit more of what's happening to our bodies when we are going to higher altitudes or than we're used to, and what's actually what we will experience and actually what's happening in our bodies.
Amazing. Yeah. So that, I mean, Chantel, you teed it up perfectly of, in a general sense, because again, this is a massive question. I mean, years of study, but generally, how is the body responding in different zones? What are some key, I guess, I don't know if reactions or indicators of the effect of altitude, what's happening within your body, and what are those kind of reactions that we're seeing?
So yeah, I think we sort of have two levels of this, right? Like, what are we experiencing? What are we noticing about our bodies? And then what is actually happening in our bodies? So typically when we are going to a higher elevation, so let's take a typical example of someone lives in Austin, Texas, and they decide to visit, I live near Jackson, Wyoming. So pretty typical. They're going to a different elevation. Some of the things that you're going to notice, probably big ones, maybe they're going to notice that it's a little bit harder to breathe. So their breathing is a little bit faster. Breathing rate is a little bit faster. And that's lungs trying to keep up with the change in the barometric pressure and the amount of available oxygen. Their heart rate is a little bit faster, so they'll notice that their resting heart rate's a little bit faster. That's also normal response to altitude. That's the blood pumping, or the heart rather, beating faster to increase the amount of oxygenated blood in the body. They may also notice that they are peeing more often, and increased urination rate. That's also a common symptom. That's one of the early symptoms, as the body is trying to it kind of comes from a hypoxic stimulus that we're getting to our kidneys, and the body is initially getting rid of plasma essentially from the blood to concentrate the red blood cells. And so your blood is becoming thicker. The red blood cells carry more the oxygen in your blood. So that's a good way to help your body get through that. If you're going a little bit higher in altitude, you may also notice some difficulty sleeping. So some people may find that they are experiencing a lot of frequent wake-ups. Typically, this is happening above 2,500 meters, so above 8,000 feet. But it could be, some people might be a little more sensitive to that. So they could be experiencing that. We'll get into this a little bit more later on specifically, but tends to be that men will experience this sort of sleep apnea more often than women at the higher elevations. And these are all normal responses to altitude. It means that your body is starting to make some really cool changes under the hood, so to speak, to help you cope with altitude. And so in the early days, you know, these are the types of things that you're going to start to notice, you know, the breathing, heart rate, things like that. But what's happening over the days and weeks is that we are getting an increase in hemoglobin. We are getting an increase in red blood cell mass. Eventually, the plasma volume that we are initially kind of dumping, it's going to start to increase again over time as our heart rate and cardiac output starts to level out. You know, that will happen within a few weeks, and we won't continue to have this sort of hyperventilation that we experience initially. Again, over a couple of weeks, that starts to decrease as we're able to counteract the hypoxic stimulus that we're having. All these things are really normal, and they're all necessary for the different physiological changes that we need to experience for our bodies to be able to stay healthy and stay alive at higher altitudes. And then as we go even higher, this is a little bit different. And maybe, Martin, that's something you want to expand on a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a great overview. I would maybe add the or stay a bit more with the timeline of those adaptations. So the body, when we go to that altitude, as I mentioned, the first kind of threshold, maybe 1800 meters, what happens is that the body senses the hypoxia, so reduced amount of oxygen molecules in the air we breathe. And so body works in a very smart way. So there is actually these receptors in different parts of the body, but the main important ones maybe are the one in aorta, the ones in the brain. So very sensitive, obviously, because we are highly dependent on oxygen to function, our brain specifically. And obviously, when it comes to performance, because it's for us, for athletes, it is a lot about performance. So you can imagine that we need the oxygen. So if there's a lack of it, the body will start to the response, basically. And so as Chantal now described, some of those adaptations happen very quickly, within minutes, let's say. So the increased breathing, rate of breathing, depth of breathing, increased heart rate. And then if we stay at that altitude or at a hypoxia, so the other adaptations will start to happen later on, because it's, some of those actually take a while and it's all interconnected. And obviously the study of altitude physiology is an ongoing thing. We still don't probably know a big part of it. I think we know that about maybe 50-60%, very large part of the our genome actually does something. It expresses something under hypoxia stress. So you can imagine that it's not only about these points, but I guess what the way we understand it, and we can agree on, these are really very important ones. It's really about trying to bring that oxygen into the body more efficiently, because there's a lack of it, and then also utilize it within the tissues, within the muscles, and becoming more efficient. So all these adaptations are actually the way for the body to just bring that to keep the function, and possibly even in to improve them. So when it comes to higher or extreme altitude, it's really about being careful to respect that process, because if we really cross maybe that 3,500 meter threshold, maybe it's not a threshold as such, but just the level, then we are really risking some of those altitude sicknesses or illnesses to occur, because we're just going too fast, and the body just cannot deal with the hypoxia. This is very individual. Some people have a tendency to get these illnesses more often, or just randomly. We just don't exactly know why there are the mechanisms behind this. But just what I want to say is to really the timeline of those different adaptations. So when we go to high and extreme altitude, it really needs to be, there needs to be certain time, so maybe a week or two, to really try to stay at that lower levels, and then for those first adaptations to kick in, to then so that the first ones actually can relax, so the heart rate starts to go down, the saturation is actually improving, saturation of oxygen in the blood, the breathing as well. And so because the other adaptations that take more longer time, they already happened, and so sort of like replaces one another. And so then for the high and extreme altitude, it's really needs to be weeks spent at those levels, and actually try to even progressively increase that level.
That's amazing. And that also brings us to kind of a next question. You alluded to altitude sicknesses. What are the common ones? I think we hear the terms HAPE and HACE used quite frequently. And where do we draw the line? And Martin, again, you kind of touched on this, between feeling these, you know, changes and these reactions, and really beginning to worry about this is going in the direction of an altitude sickness.
Let's say the first stage of some kind of illness, because we can already talk about some kind of discomfort when we go to altitude, or we're using hypoxic vents, for example, at home, and so-called simulated altitude. So it's definitely worth to observe those symptoms. So the way we feel, the way we breathe, the heart rate, the saturation, all those outputs of the body can give us some kind of insight into if we are acclimatizing or our body's just struggling too much. But then obviously that comes the symptoms like headache, nausea, dizziness, lack of cognitive function. So you obviously might not even realize, but people around you can see that you're confused, that you're losing balance or other more severe symptoms. So there are different ones. So the first stage is the AMS, acute mountain sickness. So the acute is very important. Usually happens in this acute stage of acclimatization or when we just are at altitude, so acutely exposed to hypoxia. So if we really don't respect that acclimatization process and we just go a bit too fast, too high, this can happen. And so acute mountain sickness usually is the headache, some kind of nausea or vomiting. And so the best way to is to go down, to go to lower altitudes and to recover and just to give the body time to for further adaptations. And if we don't recover, or we just, people then have a tendency to just ignore or just to push even higher, definitely not recommended. So then there are the other two more severe conditions, and they are very life-threatening. So PACE and HAPE, so high altitude cerebral edema and pulmonary edema. So those two are obviously very serious conditions and come with very severe symptoms. And this is really minutes and hours. Like it's really usually the main important solution is to bring the person down or just use the hyperbaric chamber or something else. But it's really important to say that this is very serious. Maybe Chantal, you would like to talk about those symptoms.
Yeah, I think that's something, those are all really good distinctions, Martin. I think one important thing for people to recognize when they are spending time in higher altitudes is to really pay attention to the small things, making sure that they are really getting a proper amount of rest, that they are staying well hydrated, that they are fueling well, and that they're truly paying attention to how they feel. Like, don't ignore your symptoms. Don't not tell your tent mates that you're having a headache for the last 3 days, something like that. And acute mountain sickness is really defined by headache plus some other type of symptom, right? So headache plus GI symptoms, fatigue, dizziness, impact on your activities. And so if you have, you know, just a headache, you know, be aware of it, share about that, pay attention to how you're doing, try to get a little extra rest and see how that goes. If you're getting a headache and you're feeling a little bit dizzy and you're having some stomach problems, then that's a little bit more serious. And then, as Martin said, you definitely want to consider going to a lower elevation and waiting until you're feeling a little bit better before you attempt going higher. Because if you are ignoring the small warning bells, then big warning bells are really serious, like high altitude cerebral edema and pulmonary edema. Both are life-threatening. And for cerebral edema, that's fluid accumulation in the brain. And that causes potentially fatal neurological dysfunction. And that's extremely serious. So the symptoms for that would be headache, loss of coordination, confusion, hallucination. You could have someone that's a little bit combative. You know, you're trying to help someone and they're just like really angry, really aggressive. Those are really signs to look out for in yourself, but also in your mountain partners, to be really aware and really talk about what you're experiencing on a daily basis throughout the day. For pulmonary edema, that's when we have fluid accumulating in the lungs. So that means that the oxygen exchange with outside and in your lungs is going to be impaired. So this leads to some respiratory distress. So really difficulty breathing, short breath, maybe pain in the chest, coughing, pay attention to someone's skin. You might see that they're looking a little bit blue. That's extremely serious and extremely life-threatening. So you really want to pay attention to how you're doing how your partners are doing, and thinking about monitoring your symptoms on a daily basis. So how are you sleeping? How well are you able to eat and stay hydrated? Are you having any GI symptoms? Monitoring your the oxygen concentration in your blood, so having a monitor, and sharing that information with your partners and noticing how you are changing day to day. And if you are noticing that you are, you know, getting worse instead of better, you need to speak up and you need to really take care of yourself. So it's normal that you're going to feel a decrease in your performance or a decrease in your strength and endurance, particularly in those first few weeks. Totally normal. But honor that. Slow the heck down. Take some rest. But if you're noticing, you know, at the higher elevations, definitely you're going to also notice maybe slower reaction times, impaired decision making. And again, notice those things in your partners. Talk about these things before your expedition or your trip as well, to talk about these things. Make sure that everyone in the group is on the same page about these symptoms, about the dangers, and how you can potentially help each other, because you really depend on each other when you're on in these types of environments. And so you really need to speak up and never think about, I think the biggest mistake that I see people making is like they're afraid to slow others down in the group. But you're going to slow someone down a lot if you need to spend some time in a hyperbaric bag, or you, worst case scenario, need a rescue.
That's excellent. And I think it really, it just emphasizes the fact that this mountain climbing, you know, honestly, all these sports that we do are so team dependent, and this awareness of yourself, of others, and that we have to work together. You know, it is not an individual endeavor by any means. And so just looking out for each other and being really conscientious. And I think that's actually another reason why we emphasize training so much, is because you should have a baseline of how your body feels when you are in your home turf, whether you live in Colorado, whether you live, you know, by the sea, is that you understand how your body's functioning. You understand some of your basic vitals. And so hopefully you have some awareness, some feelings of like, this is uncomfortable. And then this is like, not good.
This is dangerous.
Yeah, this is dangerous. I was going to say not good is a very simple way of putting it. But yeah, so just, you know, so much of training is really just understanding how your body feels in measurable circumstances and kind of safe circumstances, so that you can feel, hey, this is really drawing the line between okay and over the top.
If I may just add here, I agree 100% with what you just said. I think it really comes with also experience. You know, try to maybe take it as a process. If you're aiming to climb high mountains, so reach out to our team, Uphill Athlete, or you know, the guiding companies that usually have some kind of climbing plan, for example, right? To take it from from some easier mountains and then higher and higher, so that you actually are getting that experience in like technical side of things, but also, yes, knowing your body, the way it reacts to altitude, because this is quite individual, as we mentioned already. And so people still, every year, there are reports about accidents, about people getting sick and people actually also dying. And it's totally avoidable. It's really important to come humble to these places and to really take it as learning, and knowing that, you know, it might have worked five times, but the sixth time you might still struggle or just randomly fall sick, so you have to go down. Or so, yeah, I think just adding that, the humility, this approach is usually better, also for you in general, for your health, very important.
Are you ready to achieve your next trail running goal and perform at higher altitude races and adventures? At Uphill Athlete, you can train your way with our field-tested, science-backed training programs. Choose from training plans, personal coaching, or the new Uphill Athlete training membership. Check out the link in the show notes to achieve your trail running objectives and put your best foot upward. to tee off that, as you said, it's individual. And also, Chantel, you pointed out a difference with sleeping between men and women at high altitude that can often come up. Altitude has a different effect on men, a man versus a woman. And so I'd love to hear what you see some of these differences are, why these differences may occur, and how a man and a woman should approach going into altitude.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that women might experience a little differently than men. On the good side, women tend to not experience the level or degree of sleep apnea that men do. Not to say that women are never going to experience it, but generally speaking, that's an observation, but something that I think both men and women need to be aware of. For women who are premenopausal, they will experience typically a higher hypoxic ventilatory response when they are in the early to mid part of their luteal phase of their menstrual cycle. So we're talking about like post-ovulation. And this might sound like a positive thing, but since women already have an elevated breathing rate during this phase of their cycle anyway, it means that this could lead to them having some higher incidence of respiratory distress at higher altitudes. So throughout the menstrual cycle, women experience changes in their ventilatory rate, heart rate, and even their body temperature. So these are things to really consider, that these things, for women that do experience that normally during their menstrual cycle, know that some of those symptoms may be exacerbated when they are at higher altitudes. So something to be a little bit aware of. They may have to move a little bit more slowly when they're at that phase of their cycle if they are experiencing that. If they've never experienced any breathing issues, they may definitely experience some asthmatic type issues, even if they've never had problems before at their home elevation. When they are postmenopausal, they will have a similar hypoxic ventilatory response, but their cardiac response is going to be a little bit different. So their cardiovascular system's ability to increase output and increase stroke volume may be decreased because of the difference in their hormonal profile at that point in time. So again, if you know, that's why I say for everyone, and I think Martin, you've stated that as well, it's always really important to know how does your body really perform normally, and being able to recognize when it is performing or behaving abnormally when you're in a new environment. Altitude is obviously one environmental stressor, but you could also at altitude sometimes have compounding environmental stressors as well, right? You could also have altitude and heat. You could have altitude and cold. So it's really important to really always be monitoring how you're feeling, how your body is responding, regardless of whether you're male or female, and regardless of what hormonal profile your body is experiencing at that time. A secondary effect that we typically see with women is that women carry more body fat. And so women tend to be able to spare carbohydrates when they are at higher altitudes compared to men. So men's bodies will rely more on carbohydrates for fuel. And since women have more body fat, we're better able to burn fat at altitude for energy. But that also means that when we are trying to do work at a higher intensity at altitude, it's harder for women, particularly for premenopausal women who still have estrogen in their bodies, because estrogen triggers the body to spare carbohydrates. And we actually need our bodies to burn carbohydrates for harder efforts. And so that can be kind of hard to perform at a higher intensity task for women. And also for premenopausal women, progesterone naturally increases breathing rates. So depending on where a woman is at in her cycle, if she is in a phase of her menstrual cycle where progesterone levels are on the higher side, so you know that's post-ovulation into that luteal phase, the breathing rates are going to be naturally higher because of the hormones. And then if we compound that with being at higher altitudes and breathing rate being higher from that, we have kind of a double effect. So again, just something to be aware of knowing how your body normally responds, how you're feeling, what your effort level is like. It may mean that you need to slow down a little bit and be really careful about pushing your body into a higher intensity and really being mindful of your breathing and your heart rate. So those are some of the main ones. But I think in general, for any person at any phase of their life, male hormones fluctuate throughout life as well. It's no matter who you are, it's always important to be monitoring your body, monitoring your effort level, monitoring your unique experience. I think that's really critical.
Yeah, I would like to add maybe just a couple of points, but great overview from Chantal here. But women have a tendency, or female body has a tendency to hypoventilate in hypoxia, which also relates to exercise in general, not only altitude. And so this definitely becomes an issue in altitudes related hypoxia. So the body has a tendency to react slower with that increased rate of breathing. So that's the hypoxic ventilatory response. But it's kind of natural. It's related to slightly different physiology in women. Also, in general, obviously, in very general sense, lung size is smaller. The absolute lung volume in women is slightly smaller in general. Again, so that definitely affects the gas exchange surface, and so reduces the capacity. So that might be also one important point in altitude. And maybe just another last point here is for people with heavy menstrual bleeding, there is this risk of iron deficiency. So it's definitely important to monitor that, to do testing in the time before you go to the expedition or to altitude, to make sure that you get some supplementation if needed, because iron and ferritin, they are very important in those adaptations, specifically producing the hemoglobin. That's the particle in your blood that will carry the oxygen around. So if you're deficient in iron, that definitely can affect negatively the production of the new red blood cells.
Martin, I think that's a really great point. And I think something important for all athletes, male and female, when they're preparing to go to altitude or they're doing some type of pre-acclimation protocol with a tent or some other method, for all athletes to, in advance, have their iron tested, have their ferritin tested to know what are your iron stores, so that if there is a deficiency, you have time to correct it before you go to altitude, and that you get some good medical advice about supplementation potentially when you are out on your expedition or out on your hike or trek or whatever you're doing. Because without your iron stores being in a good place, you will absolutely struggle to acclimate. So that's really low-hanging fruit. So for women, it's particularly important for people who are on vegan and vegetarian diets. They also tend to be lower in iron, so that's, you know, they may need some supplementation, and there are some non-animal sources of iron supplementation that you can take as well. But even for some people, it's just maybe something that is normal for them or genetic, about their genetic makeup, that they tend to store iron a little less. And for some people, they could be on the other end of the spectrum. You could have some people that are like just taking iron supplementation because they hear that it's good for altitude, and actually their bodies now have too much iron. So please don't supplement iron without being tested and without doctor supervision, so that you make sure that you are taking the right amount and you are only taking it if you need it.
Definitely agree on that. I mean, I'm a huge fan of getting blood panels, particularly if you're going into hard training cycles or, you know, quite a bit before you're going to do your hard effort, to make sure that everything's in a good spot. I did want to touch on one thing, Martin, you said, just to get a definition of the difference between hyperventilation, which I think most people have heard that term before, and hypoventilation. And you said hypoventilation. So can you tell us the difference between the two?
So hyperventilation, or actually whatever you actually follows, that hyper is something increased or a higher rate, and then hypo is the lower. So specifically what I mentioned about the hypoventilation is that in female physiology, for different reasons, works in such a way that compared to men, that the reaction to actually increase the rate of breathing to actually catch up with the lack of oxygen is a bit slower. And so related to altitude, this can have an effect. But just want to say that reading about this specific topic, the sex differences, so between men and women in a high altitude or in altitude, is still non-conclusive. It's first the big studies about altitude physiology were just big groups of people. And so now, you know, they're trying to actually think, okay, are there these differences? And so I think it's a really good discussion what we're doing here, and trying to really talk about these topics that we already know, that can help you out there to actually make your decisions. And so, but back to your question, hyperventilation is definitely that for one of those first adaptations when you come to hypoxia, when you come to altitude. And it's actually then related to the sleep apnea, so that Chantal mentioned before. So that's actually related in a way that you breathe in more air and oxygen. So that's what you want. That's what the body wants. That's why it's kind of automatically happening, involuntarily, not automatically. But what it also causes is that we breathe out more. And what we breathe out is the carbon dioxide. And that actually offsets the balance in our bodies. And the brain also has the sensors for the carbon dioxide, not only just oxygen. And so the brain sees that, or senses, there's a like lower levels of carbon dioxide. And so basically stops breathing for seconds, or, you know, it's until the point where it's actually apnea. So basically brief stops for 10 seconds, even longer sometimes, and then you start to suffocate. So then there's this huge, loud inhale, and usually people experience this during the sleep, and so that's why it's called sleep apnea, and it's not very nice. It's not a very nice feeling. I experienced it myself, just a fun fact, on a Mont Blanc last November, and it's just so annoying. It's just so annoying. I was just, the whole night I was just basically falling asleep and woke up myself because I was not breathing. And you cannot do anything about it. It's all out of your control. And so basically spent the whole night doing this on a repeat. And it's just the first stage of the acclimatization. That's a good thing that actually usually, but I think for most people, you're acclimatized better, and so within days this disappears, this very annoying symptom.
That does sound incredibly frustrating. I actually, and please jump in on this, would assume that just based off of historical numbers of men and women that are going into high to extreme altitude, that probably a lot of the studies are just naturally geared towards men, because there just weren't women who were doing it and so able to participate in the studies. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, and also the propensity for a lot of scientific studies to think like, well, women have menstrual cycles and so they're quote unquote more complicated to study, so we'll just study it in men, you know, and then we'll just extrapolate for women. So that, I think that sense in science is now changing to realize that there are more, you know, and we have a lot more female athletes that are challenging themselves in different ways. And we have more female researchers and even male researchers who recognize the importance of studying both sexes to understand this better, to give better recommendations. So thankfully that's changing, but you know, it's, we still have, you know, if you think about general population of people who are going to these more extreme environments, you know, we're still an odd little funny group of people, right? It's still a small group.
Yeah. So let's jump to, it's our first episode. Let's just get this out of the way. But what are a few common myths that you see around altitude experiences? And you just want to be like, let's get that right out of the way. Martin, if you want to lead off.
Yeah, I can start here. So I was, what I see repetitively, like one with my coaching work, but also with my direct experience in the mountains, is that really people still don't respect the acclimatization process enough. And as I mentioned before, even these years, these seasons, there's, you know, there are accidents that are easily avoidable if people really follow that process, if they inform themselves or just reach out. And also, so again, the acclimatization takes time. So adapting to altitude takes time. We can adapt. It's individual, so everybody reacts slightly differently, but it's definitely important. I think what I've seen a lot is that fit people, maybe young people in that category, think that they'll be fine, they'll be better off, but it's actually not really correlated, the fitness level and then being able to tolerate altitude is not actually that correlated. It definitely helps, but I've seen people collapse or just faint at high altitude here being working on a Gildimity, and you could really clearly see that they were young, they were ready to climb, so they were geared up once, but at the same time there were people around that were just clearly not very sporty, and they were totally fine. So there is something about it. So also knowing that from Nepal and other big ranges, that people just go and just go directly to the base camp and actually die the next day. They just completely ignore the process to really stage it, to go step by step and go directly to 5,000 meters and higher, and it goes terribly wrong. I would say, just related to this, I would encourage people to do the research when they plan the trips to these mountains, to really, if you haven't had some experiences in those mountains, because there is a tendency for some companies to organize these trips in a very short time. So people already are asked to, or just basically the plan is to climb the mountain within like one week time, which is totally short for people, for mountains that are above 5,000 meters or 6,000 meters. So for some of them, it works out pretty well. But I just like to tell my clients specifically that if you climb the mountain without preparation in 7-8 days, you're leaving and your body is actually still acclimatizing. And you already climbed it. Okay, you got lucky, but it might have gone wrong. You might have gone sick also. And also you probably didn't enjoy it as much because you just kind of suffer through it. So I encourage them to take their time and actually respect the timeline of those adaptations and actually enjoy it. So I would say that would be something I experience quite often.
Yeah, I think that really goes to the idea that just because you get away with something doesn't mean you should have done it. And I think, unfortunately, that happens a lot in the mountains, where it's like, oh, well, I got away with it this time, or like, well, I did it. And it's like, well, you might have gotten just really lucky that one time, and that's probably not going to be a something you should hang your hat on all the time, or the basis of your future endeavors. But Chantel, what are some of your favorite altitude myth debunks?
Yeah, I think Martin, you touched on one of my favorites, is people thinking that their fitness is going to protect them. I think sometimes you have these like really fit people are often working pretty hard in their training, and they're maybe not giving themselves enough time to rest and recover before they travel. So they're training really hard, and then they get on a plane, or you know, they try to do something without being very well rested, and so they are going to struggle to acclimate. Maybe their body is depleted in some way. You know, it could be iron stores, for example. It could be that they're just fatigued, and so the body cannot adapt well. So it's important to, you know, really manage your health, take care of your health, make sure that you're healthy before you go. And there's no magic pill. So your fitness, certainly being fit and being well prepared, is definitely an advantage. But you still need to respect your body and respect the mountain and listen to your body as you're going through the process. Some people also tend to think that they've been to altitude plenty of times before, or they've climbed a mountain with a specific aggressive ascent rate and gotten away with it before, and so they think that it's always going to happen. Definitely not. There's no guarantee. I had an athlete who had a super scary experience, who had been to altitude multiple times, been to quite high altitude multiple times, never experienced any issues. And then one summer he was planning to race in Leadville. So that's, you know, spending a significant amount of time around 10,000 feet. But he'd been to that level of elevation before multiple times and even higher, never had any problems. And he ended up being helicoptered off the mountain because he had haze. Never had any kind of problem before. So again, just can't say this enough to really listen to your body, pay attention to how you're feeling, take care of yourself well, and speak up if something before it's too late. And maybe another one, this is a little silly one, that you cannot have caffeine at higher elevations. That's, I think, a common one that people say. It's not that you have to avoid caffeine, but don't overdo it. If you're someone that's used to drinking caffeine quite regularly, you might actually get a headache from removing caffeine. So if you're planning to, you know, avoid caffeine on your trip or your expedition, then do the caffeine detox before you go to the mountain. Don't do it on the mountain. then that wouldn't be good for you. And another one is sometimes people looking for the magic pill. And so for some people, they may think that taking Dymox is kind of a cure-all, and it's going to help them avoid altitude sickness, or it's going to help them ascend more rapidly, and it's going to avoid any kind of problem, right? It's kind of a magic bullet. And the truth is, there's no magic bullet. Dymox is certainly helpful for certain people under very specific circumstances, but it's not something that everyone needs to take, or that someone should just blanket take. You know, learn about it, learn what it does to your body, learn how it helps, learn how it may hinder, and make the right decision for yourself. We are not doctors, but there are really wonderful doctors out there that can give you really good information. And the truth is, there's no magic bullet. There's no guarantee. The mountain always decides. And we have to do the best job we can of taking care of ourselves, monitoring our own symptoms, and doing the best job that we can to follow a good ascent protocol that's going to keep us safe and keep us healthy, so that we can continue. The goal is always to get back down the mountain, right? You know, whether you summit or not, or whether you finish the race or not, the goal is always to make it back down the mountain safely, healthy, back to your loved one. So always keep that in mind.
Absolutely. I like to say the summit is the parking lot when you're back down. Mm.
I would like to add maybe one more, because obviously we are talking about different levels of altitude again, but maybe related to the high and extreme altitude. So for those who don't know, who are not aware of, there are ways to acclimatize also at home whilst you're at home. So just for you to know that it's all this that we just talked about the sicknesses, illnesses, and how it's risky, definitely it needed to be mentioned. But then for some people, it's just impossible to leave to leave for a long period of time, let's say for several weeks, for when it comes to these high mountains. So nowadays there are systems available that you can actually use at home. So hypoxic tents or hypoxic chambers, those are actually becoming more available in the cities, like in the commercial gyms. But mainly it's about the hypoxic tents. So you can actually pre-acclimatize before you go to the mountains. So you can still stay at home with your families, living at sea level, keep working, having your business, and then pre-acclimatize to the really good level before you leave, and actually do even reduced time on those expeditions. Because, I mean, Everest takes usually 8 weeks, until 8 weeks, to actually completely acclimatize to the base camp and then do the climb. So it really is a long time for most people to leave the job and the family. So using these systems, you can definitely make it possible. And so just another myth that I think we can confirm it works. We at Uphill Athlete, we've been using these methods. And so reach out if you want to know more.
That's great. So this is just, I mean, gosh, what a great start. I feel like we really covered a lot of amazing information, and I'm super stoked to see where we go from here. Is there anything else you two would like to add before we wrap up our intro to altitude?
I think we covered a lot of good stuff, and Martin, you touched on an important piece as well, that there are ways that people can pre-acclimate before their trip or before their acclimate before, and we'll have some great future episodes on the specifics of what that looks like, what some of those methods are. I think, you know, those the ability to purchase or rent one of these hypoxic tent systems is becoming much more affordable, or even some gyms and other facilities where there are actually rooms, climate controlled rooms, where people can train, which is also pretty cool. There's also the ability to do, there's sometimes people do like a poor man's pre-acclimation, where they will do like a heat training protocol, which helps them to improve or increase red blood muscle mass. But I think aside from those things, other things like basic stuff people should pay attention to is your general health really matters. Your iron stores and other important blood values to make sure that you're healthy before you are putting your body in a really stressful situation physiologically. We also touched on the importance of getting proper rest, staying hydrated, eating more carbohydrates. So for those people out there that are following high protein, high fat diets and avoiding carbohydrates, don't do that and then go to your expedition and then find that in the base camp everything they're providing is high carbohydrate foods. That's not going to be good for your body. So make sure that you are also following a well balanced diet, because carbohydrate consumption is really important at higher altitudes. Other things you can do is, you know, avoiding alcohol. Obviously that's going to be an additional stress when you're at higher altitudes. Respect the mountain, respect the ascension rate that works for your body, and listen to your body. Most importantly, listen to your body, listen to what's happening, and pay attention to those things already now in training. Know what's normal for you, know what feels normal for you, know what is a normal, what does your breath sound like when you are working really comfortably and sustainably, and know what your breath sounds like when you're working really hard and unsustainably. Because when you're going, even if you're training now with your watch and your heart rate strap and all that stuff, your quote unquote normal heart rates where you live are not going to be the same as they are going to be at 14,000 feet or above 4,000 meters, right? That's obviously, it's going to be different, but you're still going to know like what it feels like, what it sounds like. That's going to be something that's consistent. So start paying attention to those things. And really, you know, we, as athletes, I think we work really hard for a good chunk of our lives to ignore those signals. And so I think a lot of what we do as coaches is helping our bodies, our athletes, to learn to actually listen and actually pay attention and learn what your body's trying to tell you before it shuts you down.
I agree. I think it's, as Chantal said, it's just learn, just listen to the mountain, listen to yourself, your body. And I think for most people, they can relate. They go up there for some kind of physical challenge, but it's definitely a big mental challenge and sort of some kind of spiritual as well. A lot of self-discovery there. But I think it's not only about the summit, maybe a bit of a different topic here, but it's not only about that, you know, it's really what you put into it, how much effort, but in a way that is not putting you and your life and your health at risk. So definitely, if you listen to this, you probably have a better idea now what to look out for. So I think a great point, Chantal, about the heart rate. So I like to tell my clients that to work with RPE already during those weeks and months before the expedition, because when you come to the high altitude, the heart rate doesn't make much sense. And so the zones will not make sense, as you know. So if you're only relying on that, I mean, you will run into trouble. You will probably either push yourself too hard or too little. But I think it's mostly the pushing too hard. So knowing yourself already, working with the RPE, so rate of perceived exertion. So really knowing yourself, you just obviously you can keep using the watch, but I really use it for knowing the time, how long I've been going, and the elevation, the altitude I am at, the elevation speed. But the heart rate is really, I'm not really watching that at all. So this is a really important point, and to learn throughout the process of training. Otherwise, I think altitude is such a topic. I mean, we could just keep going for hour or two, but
yeah, let's leave something. We will be, Martin. We will be.
We will be. Yeah.
No, it's been amazing, and I love having both of you on. And actually, again, you both just teed up everything so perfectly, because Chantal, our next episode is bringing our dietitian Alisa Lieb on to talk about nutrition at altitude and considerations in the carbohydrate element, and also just saying like, hey, get used to the food that you're gonna eat on the mountain and in base camp, because that will be a huge shock to the system. Is a great primer for that. So yeah, thank you both for being on. As you can see, we have a wealth of knowledge at Uphill Athlete. So if you want to talk to Chantal or Martin and learn more from them, you can visit uphillathlete.com to chat with them through phone consults, etc. Also, there are presentations about altitude in our Level 3 memberships. I've had the privilege of seeing these presentations, and they are top-notch, really helpful to learn more about this. So thank you both very much. And thank you for listening to the Uphill Athlete podcast. If you could rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, that really helps us to help more people do their best and be safe in altitude situations. It's not just one, but a community. We are Uphill Athlete.